I'd like to turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 12. 1 Chronicles chapter 12. We'll just read verse, for sake of time, verse 23 and verse 38. And these are the numbers of the bands that were ready, armed to the war, and came to David to Hebron to turn the kingdom of Saul to him according to the word of the Lord. Verse 38, all these men of war that could keep rank came with a perfect heart to Hebron to make David king over all Israel. And all the rest also of Israel were of one heart to make David king. The Old Testament, of course, is primarily centered around Israel, who, of course, were the chosen people of God. He selected them to be his people. He revealed himself to them, unlike he did to any other people. They, of course, are a type of the saved today. The first five books of the Bible are referred to as the Pentateuch, and the theme of those books is the law of God and Israel. Again, Israel. In the Pentateuch, Moses led Israel. The next 12 books, Joshua to Esther, are referred to as historical books. That doesn't mean that the first five books aren't history. They certainly are. But these 12 books are referred to as the historical books, and they represent about 700 years of Israel's history. And it's where our text falls, in those historical books. Now, this 12th chapter gives an account of those who came to David at different times and joined themselves to him, recognizing him as their king. The chapter is basically composed of four lists. I could make it five, but four lists of those who came to David for this purpose of making him king, and they came at different times. In verses 1 through 7, there are primarily Benjamites who joined David at Ziklag. In verses 8 through 15, there are the Gadites who came to him when he was in that stronghold near the desert. And thirdly, in verses 19 through 22, there are the Manassehites who came to David. And then in verses 23 through 40, there are the masses of the nation coming to him at Hebron. Now, in these four groupings, you can really break them down to two. Those who joined themselves to David while he was at Ziklag, that would cover verses 1 through 22. And then those who joined themselves to David at Hebron, which would be covered in verses 23 through verse 40. But the chapter is set in a time of great difficulty. It is set in a time of great turmoil amongst the nation. There is much confusion. There is much unsettledness. Sounds familiar. And it is in this setting that the people of God draw near to David to proclaim him as their king. We want to speak this morning on the subject of what does our day require of us as God's people? What does our day require of us? First of all, just consider the background and the events of the text. By way of background, again, the Old Testament is centered upon Israel, God's chosen people, type of God's people today. As you begin the historical books, the book of Joshua begins the historical books and picks up the story of Israel after the death of Moses. And Joshua, of course, is seen as the leader of Israel. The book of Judges picks up after the death of Joshua. And God raises up 13 judges to lead Israel. Samuel is the last judge. And in 1 Samuel 8, verse 5, the people would demand of Samuel, because of their desire to be like everyone else, "Now make us a king to judge us like all the other nations." And then in 1 Samuel 8, verses 6 through 9, God speaks to Samuel, and he said, "Grant their request. Grant their request. They have not rejected me, thee, but they have rejected me, that I should reign over them." The Lord was no longer king in Israel, or I should say he was no longer recognized as king in Israel. That begins the history of the establishment of the kingdom of Israel. Saul, as we all know, was chosen to be the first king for many reasons. He was taller than anyone else. It goes on and on. But he reigned for 40 years. But he disobeyed God. And God would reject Saul as king. And he would commission Samuel to anoint David to be Saul's successor. In time, Saul dies. David is recognized as king in the southern part of the nation, Judah. But because of the opposition of Abner, who was the captain of Saul's armies, David was not recognized, David was not accepted as king in the northern tribes. Abner proceeds to select Saul's fourth and now oldest son. He's the only one that survived the Philistine massacre, Ishbosheth. And he proceeded to rule as king of all the nation except in Judah, where David was recognized as king. Actually, Ishbosheth was just a figurehead. He was controlled by Abner, but that's another message. The nation was greatly divided. There was a group of people siding with David to the south. They are settled on David's kingship. He is king. We're settled upon it. He is king. There's another group to the north, siding with Ishbosheth, and they are basically just clinging to the house of Saul. They liked Saul, and they're clinging to his house. Well, about 5 years after David was recognized as king in the south, in Judah, there's a battle between some of the troops of Ishbosheth, led by Abner, and some of the troops of David, led by Joab. Eventually, Abner and his forces would flee. And Abner killed the brother of Joab, Asahel, I believe was his name. And Joab, of course, this engendered a hatred in Joab that knew no rest until Abner was dead. And eventually Abner, of course, is killed. And upon his death, Two of Ishbosheth's captains are killed, and, or not killed, but they conspire to kill Ishbosheth, and they do. And they behead him, and they bring the head to David. David is greatly grieved. David is shocked by the deed of these men, and he has them killed. And then David arranges for an honorable burial for this fourth son of Saul, which brings us to verse 23. It was at this point that verse 23 of our text comes in. And there are the numbers of the bands that were ready armed to the war and came to David to Hebron, and they came to do something, to turn the kingdom of Saul to him according to the word of the Lord, or according to as God would have it done. So here you have these who stood with Saul. They had been clinging to Saul and his house. They had refused to embrace the one whom God had put upon the throne in David. But now they have come to recognize, accept, and proclaim, David is our king. They came to David, it says there in verse 23. And they did so with a very definite purpose. To turn the kingdom of Saul to him. And this is a very, very impressive scene. As you read verses 24 through verse 37, you have all these numbers of the tribes that came. And if you add up all of those numbers, there are at least 334,500 people gathered unto David at this time. That's an impressive scene. That's a lot of people. And they have come to recognize, they have come to accept, they have come to declare, David is king. That's why they're there. Prior to this, they were confused. They were divided. They were unsettled. They were a people stuck on Saul. But now they came to David to turn the kingdom of Saul over to him. So you see, at least 334,500 people standing before David, a people that have risen from their past division, a people that have emerged from the chaos, a people that have abandoned the crowd, a people that have took a stand, and there they are before David, and they are declaring, he is king. He is king. They are saying, we are not confused any longer. David is king. We are not unsure concerning this matter any longer. David is king. We are clear. This is God's choice of king, and God's choice of king we recognize is our king. That's what's happening here in this chapter. And they came to David to turn the kingdom of Saul to him. And they do so without any division. They do so without any debate. They do so without any contemplation. They are of one heart. They are in unity. They are totally convinced. They are of one persuasion. God's choice of king is our choice. We declare David as king. A remarkable event. As you read the account of the chapter, again, we said there are several different, there are records of several different times when people came to David. And as you read the whole account, you see some characteristics of these who came at various times to acknowledge David as their king. In verse 1, they were helpers in the cause of David. You don't recognize the Lord as your king if you're not a helper in his cause. Then he's not your king. We see also in verse 2 that they were armed and they were skillful. In verse 8, they were separated unto David. And they were very serious. They were fit for the battle. In verse 18, they were his. And they were on his side. And may I say once again, he's not king if you're not on his side. We see also in verse 22 that they were like the host of God. What a statement. They were like the host of God. Verse 23 and 24, they were prepared for battle. In verse 25 and 28, they were courageous. In verse 33 and in verse 38, they were men who could, or people who could stay in their assigned place. And they had a single purpose. And that was to anoint David, to recognize David as king. And in verse 39, they are with David. So throughout the chapter, there is a people who assembled at various times to passionately and boldly declare God's anointed king as their king. So let's apply all of that to ourselves. First of all, we need to recognize that David is God's anointed king. He is a type of Jesus Christ. Christ is king. Notice in Hebrews chapter 1. Hebrews chapter 1. Begin reading with verse 5. For in the which of the angels said he at any time, Thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee. And again, I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. And again, when he bringeth in the first begotten into the world, he saith, Let all the angels of God worship him. And of the angels he saith, Who maketh his angels spirits and his ministers flame of fire? But unto the Son he saith, Thy throne, O God, is forever and ever. That's God speaking to Jesus. Thy throne is forever and ever. He's king. A scepter of righteousness is the scepter of thy kingdom. Thou hast loved righteousness and hated iniquity. Therefore God, even thy God, hath anointed thee with the oil of gladness above thy fellows. Jesus Christ is God's anointed king. God has declared that Jesus Christ is king. Just as God declared that David was king. Today, the scene is similar to 1 Chronicles chapter 12. Again, the setting is one of confusion. We are living in a society that has rendered many of God's people perplexed. And all the vices of this world aid in that perplexity. Whether it be television, the internet, Hollywood, the entertainment industry, the sports industry, humanism, secularism, materialism, academia, the fads, the trends, all have the people of God, not all the people of God, but let's be honest, the majority, trying to live in the middle. They're trying to live in the middle somewhere. With their attention divided, with their allegiance divided. That doesn't work. The forces of hell, Satan's army, moved by the spirit of Antichrist, march through the land on a mission of destruction. And they're always firing their missiles of anti-God philosophies, anti-God fantasies, anti-God ideas. And they're always laying the mines and setting their traps in order to bring an entire nation under their dominance. That's going on, of course, right before our eyes. Satanic influence has saturated the land. And sadly, and ashamedly, many of the saved by grace have become spellbound and distracted by and entangled and enslaved to a world that has gone crazy. Many of God's people identify. We live in a postmodern, post-God society and culture. And again, sadly and ashamedly, many of the saved by grace have been so captivated by and so drawn to such and so mingled and integrated with corruption and the profanity and the heresy and the blasphemy of a God-despising culture that they bow themselves and sacrifice their children at the altars of humanism, intellectualism, pragmatism, political correctness, public opinion, materialism, tolerance, on and on we could go. All along professing a belief in God and yet worshiping at the altars of false gods. Worshiping at the altars and sacrificing their children. The altars of hatred for God. Many of the saved by grace have so mingled and integrated with a world gone crazy that they now make decisions based upon the standards of the godless. That makes you like them. And as a result, they find themselves in a state of spiritual degradation. They find themselves in a state of spiritual emptiness. In an attempt to get out of such, they frantically try to fill the void with more of the world, which of course doesn't work, feverishly pursuing the world. Sadly, many of the saved by grace have so mingled and so integrated with a world gone crazy that now they have no interest in real spirituality. It's sad, but there's an awful lot of people who profess to know the Lord who have little to no interest in spiritual things. But instead, they want a spirituality that'll cost them nothing. That's a counterfeit spirituality. They want a spirituality that will not hurt their precious self-esteem, and that will allow them to stay in tune with a world that's going to hell. That's what they want. These are those who profess to be God's people. And whether they're God's people or not, we're not going to debate that. They exhaust their energies in worldly matters rather than God. And they have allowed the allurements of the world to dull their spiritual taste for the bread of life. There are many who profess to be saved. They have no spiritual taste whatsoever. None. And they find spiritual things to be dull. And they find spiritual things to be tedious. And they just content themselves with the shallow. They just content themselves with a mere form of godliness and a relationship with God in name only. And they consider the worship of God as a sideline. They try to fit occasionally into their busy schedule rather than a life of commitment. I saw this a while back. At first I thought it was a joke, but it gives the father and the mother's name and the daughter's name. I'm not going to mention that. But it's from a paper in California, so I guess it's real. But if it isn't, it still makes a point. Local father, again, I'm leaving out their names, and his wife are reeling after discovering that after 12 years of steadily taking their daughter to church every Sunday, at least once every 3 months. Did you catch that? At least once every 3 months. When they didn't have a more pressing sporting commitment, that she, their daughter, no longer demonstrates the strong quarterly commitment to the faith they raised her with now that she is college age. They were just stunned at the revelation. The father said, he gives the name, "I just don't understand. Almost every single time there was a rained out game or a break between school and club and team seasons, we had her in church. It was at least once per quarter. And aside from the one tournament in 2011, we've never missed Easter. It was obviously a priority in our family. I just don't get where her spiritual apathy is coming from." And that's what's really sad. They don't get it. "I can't tell you how many times we prayed the prayer of Jabez on the way to a game," added her mother. Go to Chronicles and you'll find that. "You know, the more I think about it, the more this illustrates how the church just keeps failing this generation," lamented the father. They noted that they have plans to chat with the pastor of their church after their younger son's soccer season calms down a bit. But whether it's true or not, whether this article's true, that it is true. And it is pathetic, but that's where we are today. And that doesn't apply to most here. It may apply to some. We live in a time when, sadly, many of the saved by grace have become so mingled, so integrated with the world, that their lives are more characterized by the world than spiritual things. Their lives are more characterized by unbelief than faith. Their lives are characterized more by worry than assurance, more by frustration than peace, characterized more by discouragement and misery than joy, more characterized by doubt than godly conviction, and more swayed by the world than they are, "Thus saith the Lord." And more influenced and impacted by the world's ways than God's ways. We live in a time when, sadly, many of the saved by grace have become so mingled, so integrated with the world that their hearts have been stolen. They have fallen victim to the traps of the flesh and the traps of the world and the traps of Satan. And they have no spiritual interest. They have no spiritual interest. I really don't know. Sometimes I'm tempted to ask. Maybe I will. Some people who are so irregular. What made you come today? I'm just curious. You've missed the last 5 weeks. I don't understand how that thought process works. Explain it to me. What made you decide to come today? It's pitiful. And I realize I am preaching to the choir. My younger years, I would have saved this message till others were here, but I've learned that don't work. And that's not how God would do it. We live now in a time where many of God's people, let's be honest, they have more invested in the world than they do the church. They have more invested in the world than they do spirituality. And they invest their children more in the world than they do spiritual things. And I'll be honest, I don't have a whole lot of sympathy. I feel sorry for the kids, but I don't have a whole lot of patience when a parent like that comes to me and says, "We just don't understand." Well, let me tell you why it is. They are consumed with worldly mindedness, covetousness, idolatry, results in spiritual coldness, pride, bitterness, jealousy, pettiness, hypocrisy. Hypocrisy has become a way of life for some. Spiritual shallowness. I hate spiritual shallowness. I don't hate it in a babe, but I just can't hardly stand it in someone who's been saved for years. Spiritual formality. There's no doubt that the forces of hell have mounted a full-scale assault on biblical values. But what is sad is many of God's people have adopted Satan's agenda. They really have. We as God's people must realize our real need. What do we do in times like this? What are we required to do in times like this? What must we do? Well, we need to recognize the real issue, the real need. And what we must do is what's recorded here in 1 Chronicles chapter 12. Here is a people who were divided. They had mixed emotions. They were unsettled. They were stuck on Saul. They're clinging to Saul's throne. But now, they assemble around David, God's anointed one, and they're ready. And with one heart, in one accord, without any apology, with no sense of division, without any confusion, they point to David and say, "He is our king." That's what we need today. For God's people to rise above the mess, to rise above the apathy and point to Jesus Christ and say, "He's my King. And I'm going to live for Him." What we need today, well, we just need to come up with more contemporary hymns. Not so. Well, we just need to have a more appealing and acceptable message. Again, remember who you're appealing to. You are appealing to those who have adopted the agenda of Satan. I'm sorry, I do not want to appeal to them. That's not what we need. What we need is for men and women, fathers and mothers, boys and girls, who will rise above and emerge from the madness and the confusion of the world and will be willing to abandon the crowd, the fads, the trends, the ways, the thoughts, the pursuits of the devilish world, come out of their newfound comfort zones and step up, stand up, speak up, and say, "I'm not confused about this. I do not, the jury is not out. I do not need time to think about it. Jesus is my King." That's what we need. That's what needs to happen. What we need today is what we see here in our text. for a people without hesitation. Why would you hesitate? Those who claim to be saved, why would you hesitate in declaring that He is your King? Where is it that would cause you to doubt? Why do you have to think about that? You shouldn't have to. But they came. They were stirred. They had passion. They had zeal. They had boldness. They had backbone. They had resolve. They had steadfastness. That's what we need today. To stand up and say, God has chosen His Son, Jesus, to be King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And I'm not pursuing money. I'm not pursuing fame, fads, or trends. And I'm tired of the crowd. But I am serving Jesus Christ. He's my King. That's what we need today. Husbands and fathers, and wives and mothers of and young children, to step out, to stand up, to speak up, and say, Jesus came into the world and lived a perfect righteousness for me. And He went to the cross with my sins upon Him. And He paid a sin debt that I could not pay. And He went to the grave. And He arose victorious from death and the grave for me. And I'm not confused. And I'm not unsure about this matter. And I'm not ashamed about it. He is King. He is Lord. He is Master of my life. That is what we need. In these days, is a people that will stand up and declare that Jesus is their King. Come out of the mass of chaos. Emerge from the nonsense of neutrality. Well, I just want everybody to be happy. Well, they're not going to be. Arise from the nonsense of neutrality and indecision. You say, well, my family, they didn't go to church regularly. Well, break the mold. My family wasn't spiritual. Break the mold. Quit using that as an excuse. Abandon the crowd. And say, as for me, He's my King. Just like Joshua said, as for me and my house, we'll serve the Lord. He's saying, the rest of you do whatever you want. You make that decision yourself. But as for me, we're serving God. This is the need of our individual lives. As for me, He's King. That is the need of every husband. That is the need of every wife. Just a simple recognition that Jesus is my King will prevent a lot of marital problems. I'm not saying it'll do away with them, but it'll help you deal with them. Sons and daughters need to say the same thing. He's my King. As a congregation, 334,500 in our text. We're nowhere near that, but boy, we'd be a host of God if everybody at Home Baptist Church would stand up and say, He's my King. Jesus is my King. That's the need of marriages. That's the need of homes. That's the need of the Lord's churches. God help us that we would recognize Jesus as our King. That's the need. That's the issue of our day as God's people. Who's my King? Who's my Master? And it'll show in your life. It'll show in your life. Remember Jesus said, "Why call you me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say?" A lot of people, I'm saved. I know I'm saved. I don't have any desire to be in church. I don't have any desire to read the word. I don't have any desire to pray, but I know I'm saved. Why call you me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say? I believe many of us here today have already said with clarity and plainness, He is my King. I'm thankful for each one that's here that has clearly and plainly declared, He is my King. We need to declare it every day. But there are some, let's be honest, for you to say that's going to be quite a stretch. It's going to be quite a stretch. All hail the power of Jesus' name. Let angels prostrate fall, bring forth the royal diadem, and crown Him Lord of all. Ye chosen of Israel's race, ye ransomed from the fall, hail Him who saves you by His grace, and crown Him Lord of all. Let every kindred, let every tribe on this terrestrial ball, to Him all majesty ascribe, and crown Him Lord of all. Oh, that with you yonder sacred throng, we at His feet may fall, will join the everlasting song and crown Him Lord of all. Let me say this, He's Lord, whether you recognize Him as Lord or not. He's King, whether you do so, whether you recognize it or not. One day you'll face Him, and you will see that He is King, and every knee will bow, and every tongue will confess that He is Lord. We ought to be doing that right now. We ought to bow to Him every day and confess every day He is King. Remember Martha and Mary, the Master is come and calleth for thee. Let's be honest, if you were to say that to a lot of God's people, they would have to give long thought, well, which Master are you talking about? Because they don't have one Master. And Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount said, if He's not the Master, if the world's your Master, He's not. Plain and simple. He's not just your Master on Sundays. You know, we need to crown the Lord. Recognize Him as our King. Do that every day. Thank God, we that are married, if your spouse recognizes Him as King, you ought to thank God. Heirs together of the grace of life. Doesn't mean there's no problems. Doesn't mean there's never an argument. But He's the King. He's the King. Brother Larry, would you come and lead us a verse of song?